Frey says.
Won't he notice if some is missing?
No, Leland says. I drink it all the time. We just have to be careful with the cans. I normally ditch them in the dumpster behind Eddie's.
This is a complete lie.
Leland has never drunk her father's beer. She can't stand the taste. And she has no idea if Steve Gladstone will notice cans missing, though there are at least two cases in the fridge, so she kind of doubts it.
Cool, Frey says. I'll be over in a little while.
Leland races up to her room to pick an outfit and curl her hair. She puts the Police album, Ghost in the Machine, on her turntable and dances around. He's coming. Frey is coming. A little while ends up being 2 hours later, 9 o'clock, late enough that Leland has already spiraled through self-doubt and convinced herself that Frey won't show. She's wearing her red bikini under her Jordache jeans and a velour top. She has cracked open one of her father's beers. She pulled 6 out of the back. When you open the fridge, you don't even notice any missing. And she has poured a bag of Utz chips into a bowl and opened a container of onion dip, because her mother, Jerry, says people always appreciate a snack. The hot tub is bubbling like a witch's cauldron under the cover, and it's this that Leland suspects might get her in trouble. The oil bill. Her father is energy conscious. But why even have the hot tub if they can't use it? When the knock finally comes, Leland's heart leaps. She has finished one beer and feels as light and floaty as a spirit in the material world. Hey, she says when she opens the door. Frey looks so fine. He has on a gray hooded sweatshirt under his Calvert Hall lacrosse jersey and jeans, and his high-top sneakers are, as ever, untied. He's holding a pair of swim trunks.
Haley, he says.
They lock eyes, and Leland wonders why it has taken them so long to shed the blessings and acknowledge what has been true for a while now. They are meant to be together. When Leland looks back on that night, it seems almost painfully romantic in a nostalgic 1980s way. They each crack a beer. Frey changes into his trunks in the powder room. He helps Leland lift the top off the hot tub. They climb in, sitting on the same bench but not touching. Leland has the stereo in the rec room cranked to 98 rock, and the back sliding door is open so they can hear strains of Radio Gaga and When Doves Cry. They tap their cans of Natty Bo together and drink. They start kissing during We Belong by Pat Benatar. It happens naturally, like a magnet is drawing them together. It isn't Leland's first kiss or even her first tongue kiss. That was Jay Pitcock after the 8th grade dance back in May. But this is different. Frey is skilled with his tongue. He tastes like beer. He knows to put a hand on the back of her neck and pull her toward him. When they finally break apart, Leland is dizzy, dazzled.
I'll grab more beers, Frey says.
He hoists himself out of the tub, and Leland watches him leave wet footprints on the rec room floor. When he disappears from view, she gets a crazy idea, then talks herself out of it, then decides to just go for it. Tonight is the night her life changes. She takes off her bikini top. Frey reappears, holding a six-pack by the plastic rings. Leland raises her bare breasts above the waterline. Her nipples are instantly hard.
Whoa, Frey says.
He leaves the beer to the side and starts kissing Leland again. One of his hands finds her nipple and he rubs it back and forth, a feeling so exquisite that Leland feels like she's going to dissolve. Then he lowers his mouth to her nipple and gently sucks. She can see his erection poking up in his trunks. She wants to touch it but doesn't, because her mother has given her all kinds of instructions about what can happen if you lead a boy along too far. She will hold Frey at second base tonight. second base with Fraser Dooley. It's so crazy, Leland can hardly believe it. A few weeks after Leland and Frey start dating, Coop and Frey are invited to a high school party thrown by a friend of Alana Bratton's whose parents are away. It will be mostly Bryn Mawr girls and Calvert Hall boys. Leland and Mallory go to Garrison Forest, so they won't know anyone, but Leland wheedles them an invite anyway. Once they get to the house, a mansion on Roland Park Drive, Coop and Frey disappear to do beer bongs, leaving Leland and Mallory to fend for themselves in the kitchen. The good news is that Alana spots them and takes them under her beautiful blonde wing. She gets the girls glasses of real champagne, Moët Chandon, that someone has lifted from the wine fridge. "I'll introduce you around," Alana says. "I should probably go find Frey," Leland says. Alana laughs. "Let him come find you." Which is exactly what happens an hour later. Leland and Mallory are in the library playing a drinking game called Three Man with two Calvert Hall seniors. One of them, a kid named Penn Porter, drapes his arm over Leland's shoulders just as Frey walks in.
"Get your hands off her, Porter," Frey says.
Leland jumps to her feet.
"We weren't doing anything," she says.
She's so drunk her words are slurred, and Mallory is slumped over on the green velvet sofa, eyes at half-mast. Frey storms out of the library. Leland wants to chase after him, but she can't leave Mallory drunk and alone with two senior boys. That's how date rape happens. She appeals to Penn Porter.
"Can you help me get her to her feet? She's Cooper Blessing's sister."
Penn rolls his eyes but obliges. He and Leland ease Mallory up.
"Are you dating Fraser Dooley? That guy has issues. Seems to me you can do better."
Leland leads Mallory through the house. She finds Frey in the kitchen, swilling from a bottle of Jim Beam.
"We're ready to go," Leland says.
"Great,"
Frey says, his eyes flashing with what Leland understands then are his issues. Rage, jealousy, alcohol.
"Ask your buddy Penn to get you home."
"Frey," Leland says, "we weren't doing anything."
"He had his arm around you,"
Frey says, swigging from the bottle again. Just the smell is enough to make the room spin.
"I didn't see you fighting him off."
"You left me by myself for over an hour," Leland says. "What did you think would happen?"
He shrugs. "Just goes to show, I can't trust you."
Leland would like to say that this is an isolated incident, but the entire 3 years that Leland and Frey date are marked with similar explosions, like firecrackers on a string. She becomes only too used to what she comes to think of as Frey's white-hot sulk. But there is love, too. Real love. Desperate love. Fraser clinging to Leland, pressing his face into her neck and murmuring,
"Please, baby, don't ever leave me."
Now, as Cooper turns down the no-name road that leads to Mallory's cottage, and she sees the ocean glittering in the distance, Leland marvels at how much time has passed and how much has happened. Leland went on to have a decade-long relationship with a woman. Frey became a billionaire. A billionaire? What must Penn Porter think about that? Leland's father, Steve Gladstone, went on to divorce Leland's mother and marry Frey's mother, Sloane Dooley. Technically, now Leland and Frey are step-siblings. These are the kinds of things that only happen in novels. In fact, Fifi wanted to write about it, but Leland put her foot down.
"Where's Jake?"
Leland asks when they pull up to the cottage.
"Inside," Coop says. "He wanted some time to himself."
No doubt, Leland thinks. If what happened between her and Fraser is one novel, then what happened between Jake McLeod and Mallory is another. Oh boy, is it. When they walk in,
There's music playing. Cat Stevens singing Hard-Headed Woman. And Jake McLeod is standing at Mallory's bookshelves, running a finger over the spines.
"I'm glad you're listening to this song now," Fraser says. "Get it out of your system, so we don't have to hear it again."
Jake turns, smiles, and the men shake hands. Leland follows up, hugging Jake and kissing him on the cheek.
"Don't listen to him," she says.
"Leland, you're in Mal's room," Cooper says.
"You can have Mal's room," Leland says to Jake.
"I'm in the guest room," Jake says. "That's where I was the first summer."
"Frey, you can take Link's room," Coop says. "I'll take the sofa."
Leland carries her bag into Mallory's room and shuts the door behind her. The room is lovely, with its huge white canopy bed and peach and green attached bath. Leland kicks off her shoes, sits on the bed, and stares at the ceiling.
"Can you see us, Mal?" she whispers. "I hope so. I very dearly hope so."
Jake. He reminds himself that this weekend is for Cooper, not for him. He also reminds himself that, although it's Labor Day weekend, it won't be like any other Labor Day weekend that Jake has spent on this island. Mallory isn't here, and nobody knows about their rituals but her. Friday night, they eat at home, just like Jake and Mallory always did. Only instead of simple burgers, corn, and sliced tomatoes, Cooper goes to the Nantucket Meat and Fish Market and returns with thick, marbled ribeyes, blocks of ruby red tuna, half a dozen twice-baked potatoes, colorful vegetable skewers, a container of Caesar salad, two pies, peach and blueberry, and a container of vanilla Häagen-Dazs.
"And a charcuterie and cheese platter," Coop says, "in honor of my mother and her penchant for hors d'oeuvres. I also got a case of wine."
Coop pours glasses of some obscure Riesling that he was tickled to find. Frey has water. And they all go out to the porch that faces the ocean. Cooper raises his glass.
"To Mallory," he says.
Jake has trouble swallowing. It's a clear evening, warm and summery. Jake watches the waves curl and crash, and he feels that Mallory is here somewhere, but where? In the golden sand, in the soft quality of the light? Jake is sure she would want them to be swimming. They're not that old, after all, and it's not that cold. Jake sets his glass down, heads inside to change into his suit, and then goes charging past everyone down the slope of the beach and into the water. Cooper joins Jake a few minutes later, and the two men bob in the waves as they gaze up at Frey and Leland, who are deep in conversation on the porch.
"I just remembered that Mallory told me those two used to have a thing," Jake says. "A thing that refused to die," she called it. "That was back in high school," Coop says.
"It's dead, believe me, long dead."
"Thanks for inviting me here, man," Jake says. "I know you didn't like what your sister and I had going on."
"You loved her," Coop says.
"That's all that matters to me. I'm the last person who gets to comment on what kind of relationship is right and what kind is wrong. The minute I realized I'd fallen in love with her, I was right here," Jake says. "It was maybe year 3 or 4. It was in the morning, and I was swimming when your sister got home from her run. She came out to the porch to stretch, and she didn't see me, so I could appreciate her without her knowing it. And I remember thinking, I love that girl." "She had a light inside her," Coop says. "A funny, innocent light. A good person light." "I should have left Ursula and married her," Jake says. "There were dozens of times I wanted to do it, but I was afraid. I was afraid of life without Ursula. I was afraid your sister would turn me down. And I think we were both afraid that once we were officially together, our love would seem regular. And like regular love, it would die." Remember that 1 year Mal and I met you at PJ's at Christmas time, and the two of you were dancing by the jukebox? I should have figured out what was going on with you two back then.
You should have, Jake says, but you were too busy chatting up Stacy.
Coop splashes him.
I've got first shower.
Right before dinner, Jake gets an idea. He searches through the cabinets until he finds a mason jar, and then he goes out the back door and snips the last remaining hydrangea blossom off the bush and puts it on the harvest table as a centerpiece. Now it feels like Mallory is there. They all sit at the narrow table, which is lit only by votive candles. Jake recalls the year Mallory decided to use tapers, and one fell while Jake and Mallory were in the bedroom fooling around, and the cottage nearly burned down. And one of the firemen who showed up was Mallory's ex-boyfriend, JD. After he finishes his second glass of wine, he considers telling this story, but it feels too precious to share. Leland says,
"Let's go around the table and say which of Coop's wives was our favorite. My favorite was Tish."
Cooper laughs. He really is a good sport, Jake thinks.
"Tish was my least favorite," Coop says. "She was in love with someone else when she married me. Her family friend, Fred from San Francisco. They've been happily married for over 20 years and have a business flipping houses in Nob Hill. Their daughter goes to Stanford." "My favorite was Valentina," Frey says. "She was a sweet woman."
"Sweet," Coop says,
"but using me to escape an arranged marriage."
"Did she go back to Ecuador?" Jake asks.
"Oh, yes," Cooper says. "I'm not sure if she ended up with Pablo. That was the guy her parents wanted her to marry. I haven't heard from her in nearly 25 years.
He stabs a piece of steak with his fork.
"It seems surreal that I could have stood at the altar at Roland Park Presbyterian and taken a lifelong vow to stay with someone, and then that person and I split a few months later, and I never see or hear from her again."
Leland digs into her twice-baked potato.
"I hate to say this, but I can't even remember who wife number four was. Did I meet her?"
"Tamala," Coop says. "Poli-sci professor at Georgetown. She had three teenagers that took up a lot of her time and energy. One was gender transitioning. Her first husband was killed in a highway crash. The kids were devastated, and they resented me. We eloped in Antigua. That was romantic, but then it was back to reality, and reality was challenging."
"How long did that one last?" Jake asks.
He can't remember much about Tamala either. He does remember Coop eloping, because Ursula had been relieved to be spared another wedding, and Jake had felt robbed of a chance to see Mallory.
2.5 years, Cooper says.
"The irony is that I'm still in touch with the kids. They love me now."
"Amy was nice," Jake says. He met Amy at a Johns Hopkins alumni event in D.C. She had kind brown eyes and a way of tilting her head to let you know she was really listening to you.
"That was the problem," Coop says. "Amy was nice, sweet, accommodating, eager to please. There was no mystery, no intrigue, no edge."
"And that's what you're attracted to?" Leland asks. "You fall in love with the edge? The crazy parts, the dangerous parts?"
"I'm not sure," Coop says, draining his wine. "I'm not sure what's wrong with me."
"There's nothing wrong with you, Coop," Leland says. "I mean, this group isn't exactly filled with spokespeople for successful relationships."
Jake frowns at his plate. It's true that he and Ursula are divorced, but that they stayed married for so long feels like a success. However, he would say his most successful relationship was the one he had with Mallory. He's probably deluding himself.
"I notice nobody chose Crystal as his or her favorite," Frey says.
Coop groans.
"Crystal,"
he whistles.
"In some sense, Crystal is the reason we're all here.
30 years ago, when we did this the first time, Crystal called and demanded I come home.
Oh, yes, Jake remembers it well. He's always wanted to send Crystal a thank you card. It was because of Crystal that he and Mallory got together.
Cooper says, I wonder how life would have been different if I'd just ignored Crystal when she called. What if I stayed and went to the chicken box like I was supposed to? Maybe she would have called off the wedding. And maybe, without making that first mistake, I could have avoided the others as well.
Coop leans in toward the candlelight. His face, now weathered with age and experience, glows a pinkish orange.
If I'd stayed on the island on this night 30 years ago, so much would have been different.
Jake nods slowly. He can't bear to imagine things unfolding any differently than they had.
It's probably safe to assume things worked out the way they were supposed to.
Amen,
Frey says.
Well, I'm not sure about you guys, Coop says, standing up and tossing his napkin on his plate. But I'm not missing out on the chicken box tonight.
The chicken box looks exactly the same. The concrete floor is sticky with beer, and there's a crush of people at the bar. The only difference between now and the first time Jake set foot in the place in 1993 is that now every single person is holding a cell phone. The band is on stage singing Just the Two of Us by Grover Washington Jr., a song so old it's new again, apparently. And up front, there's a group of people dancing and taking videos of themselves dancing. Leland and Frey opted to stay home, so it's just Jake and Coop on this nostalgic adventure. They're by far the oldest people here. They are gray-haired geezers, and Jake trains himself to keep his eyes off the scantily clad girls his daughter's age.
I'm going up front to dance, Coop says. Have fun, Jake says. I'll be at the bar.
He chooses the less populated side, over by the pool tables, where there's a bit of breathing room. It takes so long for the bartender to notice him that when she finally does, Jake orders 4 Coronas, 2 for him and 2 for Coop. Cooper, however, is nowhere to be seen, and Jake doesn't want to try moving 4 beers through this crowd, so he stays put and starts drinking. A female voice says,
I'll give you $20 for one of those.
Jake turns. There's a woman in a white t-shirt and cut-off jean shorts with a long blonde braid standing next to him. She's in her 40s somewhere, maybe even her late 40s, though he'd be too afraid to hazard a guess.
Have one, he says. Please, my treat.
You're my hero, she says.
She takes one of the cold bottles and rolls it across her forehead.
It's my girlfriend's birthday and she dragged me here. It's fun to dance, but it's hard to not feel completely geriatric.
Tell me about it, he says.
He offers his hand.
I'm Jake.
She has a nice, firm shake.
Brooke Schuster, she says. You look familiar to me for some reason. Have we met before?
Jake stares at the lime wedge choking the neck of his bottle.
No, I don't think so.
Are you sure? She says, because I swear.
I'm Jake McLeod, he says,
and when that doesn't clear up the confusion on her face, he adds,
my ex-wife, Ursula de Guernsey.
Brooke snaps her fingers.
Yes, that's where I know you from.
She takes a sip of her beer.
Well, if it makes a difference. I voted for her, and I was sorry to see her lose.
Everything in life works out as it should, Jake says.
Spoken like a man who wants to change the subject, Brooke says, and I can't blame you. What are you doing here at the box?
Jake says, reliving the past with a buddy of mine from college.
He takes another quick look at Brooke. She's pretty, he decides, and the cut-off shorts are giving him strong Mallory vibes. He checks her left hand. She's wearing a lot of silver, but nothing that looks like an engagement ring or wedding band.
So here it is, finally. An opportunity to have a conversation with a grown woman in real life. He can practically hear Bess urging him along.
Come on, Dad. You have to get back out there.
But dating, or even chatting up someone, feels like so much effort. Getting to know someone from scratch, starting all over with personal histories, figuring out what makes someone else tick. He's not sure he's up for it. Brooke sets her beer firmly down on the bar.
I'll probably regret saying this in the morning, but I had something of a celebrity crush on you.
On me? Jake knows he sounds surprised, though he's aware there was a small part of the female electorate across the country who turned a Jake McLeod crush into a thing. There had been an article in The Cut entitled, "The Very Real Sex Appeal of Mr. UDG." At nearly every event Jake did on behalf of his wife, someone would slip a note to him or brazenly approach his security detail, asking for a private meeting. Jake always told Ursula about these overtures, and when she could spare a few moments of her attention, she would pat his cheek and say, "I'm well aware how appealing you are, the adoring, devoted husband, handsome and well-spoken, and I'm grateful." This patronizing response had stoked Jake's resentment. Ursula only cared about how Jake's persona reflected on her, but Jake had continued to be upfront about every woman who approached him in the name of propriety. Brooke says, "You're the executive director of the CFRF, and my nephew Charlie." She stops and her eyes shine with tears. "We lost him to cystic fibrosis a few years ago."
"I'm so sorry," Jake says. "And I didn't mean to be flip when I said everything works out the way it's supposed to. In my business, I know that's not the case. How old was he?"
26, Brooke says. "He was my sister's only child."
"That's so difficult," Jake says. "I lost my twin sister to CF when we were 13.
"I know," Brooke says. "I read the profile of you in Time. I just want you to know how grateful I am for all the work you've done, the money you've raised for research. You became my sister's personal hero."
When she blinks, a single tear rolls down her flushed cheek.
"I can't believe I'm talking to you here, at the chicken box."
Jake wants to take the conversation in a lighter direction, but how? He has no experience talking to women like this, as evidenced by the fact that Brooke is now crying.
"Do you live here year-round?"
"I do," Brooke says. "I teach English at the high school."
"You... what?"
Jake says. He feels a surge of energy course through him.
"Did you know my friend Mallory Blessing?"
Brooke's face drops. "I only knew of her," she says. "Dr. Major hired me to replace Mallory." Before Jake can react, this is Mallory's replacement? Cooper appears, sweaty and grinning.
"Why'd you leave?" he asks Brooke. "Band's just getting started."
"I was thirsty," Brooke says.
She looks between Cooper and Jake. "Do you guys know each other?"
"Best friends," Coop says.
He lifts one of the unclaimed Coronas off the bar and takes a swallow. Coop looks at Jake.
"Brooke is here with Mallory's friend Apple. It's Apple's birthday."
Whoa, Jake thinks. It's a small island. He listened to Mallory talk about Apple for years and years. Her best friend, the guidance counselor at the high school, married to Hugo, mother of twin boys who might be in high school or even college by now. But Jake never met Apple, and Apple doesn't know Jake exists.
"I'm sure Apple is wondering where I've gotten to," Brooke says.
She offers Jake a tentative smile.
"Want to join us on the dance floor?"
Jake knows the fun, good sport answer is, sure, why not? But dancing up front at the chicken box is too far out of his comfort zone.
"You kids go have fun," he says,
and he feels only the slightest pinch of regret when Cooper takes Brooke by the hand and leads her away. When the lights come on and the bell rings for last call, Jake wanders through the bar, weaving around couples making out, taking selfies, drunkenly debating where to go next, until he finds Coop standing with Brooke near the exit. The three of them step out into the warm, dark night.
"We closed the box," Coop says.
"A dubious distinction," Brooke says, "especially if one of my students finds out."
"Brooke is a high school English teacher," Cooper says. "She was hired to..."
"Yes," Jake says. "She told me."
"That's crazy, right?" Coop says. "So, should we go get pizza?"
Brooke laughs. "I'm afraid I have to call it a night." She twirls her braid and looks up at Jake in a way that seems meaningful. "It was nice to meet you guys. I hope to see you both on Sunday."
"What's Sunday?" Jake asks.
"Apple is hosting a beach picnic at 40th Pole," Brooke says. "She invited you both."
"We'll be there," Coop says. "Let me walk you to your car."
"I'll be fine," she says. "I'm just across the street." She looks at Jake again. "It was nice meeting you guys." With that, she slips across the street, and both Coop and Jake watch her until she disappears.
"Is it Sunday yet?"
Coop says. In the morning, Jake tiptoes out of his room so as not to disturb Coop, who is sprawled across the big white sofa that Mallory had nicknamed Big Hugs. Jake pours himself a cup of coffee. It's the Frayed Edge Platinum that Frey brought as a gift, which was an excellent surprise because it retails for $45 a pound, and steps out the back door to tie up his running shoes. Thanks to the wine, the beers, and the late night, Jake's head feels like it's stuffed with cotton batting. But the morning is clear, with just a hint of coolness in the air. Autumn is coming, and Jake doesn't want to waste another second sleeping. Back when he used to visit Mallory, he would only sleep a few hours per night. The rest of the time he would spend watching Mal, memorizing her face, drinking her in. And yet he was never tired. He always left the island with his emotional batteries recharged. Perfect love existed, he would think. It existed here on Nantucket. He sets his cup of coffee on the porch railing and listens to his joints pop as he touches his toes. Then he sets off running down the no-name road, which meanders along Myokomet Pond. He heads all the way out to Surfside Road, then loops around to the other side of the pond, and only then, when he's hot and sweaty and parched dry, does he realize he's come too far. He can't get back to Mallory's cottage this way without a significant beach walk. This, however, will be shorter than retracing his steps, so he sits on a rock to take off his shoes. He becomes mesmerized by the clear green water lapping at the muddy shore. Is he thirsty enough to drink a handful of pond water? No, but close. He's just about to head up over the dunes to the beach when he sees a woman walking a Bernese mountain dog, holding the dog's leash in one hand and a bottle of water in the other. She looks like a goddess from a Greek myth.
"Hey!"
the woman calls out. Jake wonders if he's trespassing. When she gets a few steps closer, Jake sees that it's Brooke. Her hair has been let out of its braid, and it's long and wavy under a navy blue Nantucket Whalers baseball cap. "Oh, hey," Jake says. This is like magic, he thinks. He would be lying if he said he hadn't thought about Brooke the night before and again during his run. He had been looking forward to seeing her on Sunday and had even toyed with inviting her to the CFRF gala in Boston at the end of October as his guest. He's not sure what he's thinking. He lives in South Bend, Indiana, and has no plans to move to Nantucket. No, if he'd wanted to do that, he would have done it 30 years ago. He waves at Brooke and pushes himself to his feet. He's so overheated he's seeing stars.
This is Walter Cronkite, Brooke says, and Jake laughs. You can call him Walt.
Jake spends a minute rubbing Walt's head. He's always wanted a Bernese Mountain Dog, but Ursula pointed out that they didn't have time to take care of a pet. Jake thinks it's telling that Brooke has the exact kind of dog that Jake wants. Cool woman, cool dog.
Would you like some water? Brooke asks.
She hands him the unopened bottle that she's holding. It's seductively frosted with condensation.
Yes, please,
Jake says, and he downs half the bottle in one gulp.
Thank you, you just saved my life.
I'm glad I bumped into you, actually,
Brooke says. Her expression grows a little shy.
I had a question.
Oh, yeah? What's that?
Jake says. The water has revived him like a plant. He's sturdy, upright, ready to get to know this woman better. After all, the connection is uncanny. She said she had a celebrity crush on him, she lost a nephew to CF just as he lost a sister, and she took Mallory's job at the high school. For all Jake knows, Mallory has, somehow, sent this woman to him. Because what are the chances that he would meet her in a crowded bar last night and then see her again this morning?
I was hoping you would give me Coop's cell phone number, Brooke says. He was really great.
Frey. He wakes up on Saturday to 2 missed calls and 3 text message alerts from Dead to Me, who is Anna, his ex-wife. Frey won't take the bait. He sets his phone down on the nightstand, rolls over, and gathers Leland up in his arms. She stirs as he kisses her shoulder.
Good morning, she whispers. I'm happy to see this wasn't all just a dream.
Not a dream,
Frey says, and he moves his mouth from her shoulder to the curve of her neck.
I'm real.
They make love again, quietly, because the cottage is small, and despite the grand renovation, you can still hear people thinking in the next room. Frey hasn't felt this kind of unbridled desire in 4 decades. It's like he's back in high school. In the summer of 1985, Frey and Leland used to sneak out in the middle of the night to skinny dip in the country club pool, then have sex on the tennis courts. The difference between now and then is that Frey knows what he's doing, and so does Leland. She spent over 10 years in a relationship with a woman, an idea that Frey finds sexy. When Cooper told Frey that Leland would be coming on this reunion weekend, Frey never imagined they would end up in bed together. He'd been too wrapped up in the drama and pain surrounding his split from Anna. Getting involved with another woman, even his long-ago first love, was the furthest thing from his mind. But chemistry is chemistry. And Frey and Leland have always had it. Things had started to seem promising the night before, after Jake and Coop left for the chicken box. Frey didn't have many rules when it came to his sobriety, but no bars was one, and Leland said she didn't want to go either. Frey thought maybe she was just tired. They were older now. At home, Frey liked to be in bed by 9, something Anna found maddening. But as soon as they heard the Jeep rumble off down the no-name road, Leland grabbed a blanket from a basket by the sofa and said, "Come with me." She spread the blanket out on the beach. She lay down and patted the spot next to her. The second Frey opened his eyes to the starry sky above, and listened to the crash and roll of the waves, he decided to share a realization he'd had earlier, but had seemed too private to talk about at dinner.
It's the 30th anniversary of my sobriety, he said.
Tonight?
The Friday of Labor Day weekend 30 years ago, yes, he said. Do you remember that night? You and I and Mal and Jake went to the box, and Coop stayed home to talk to Crystal. I went to the bar to get you a Chardonnay. You very specifically asked for one from the Russian River Valley. I'll never forget that. And they didn't have it, of course. They didn't have any white wine, only wine coolers. So I got you a beer instead, but then I couldn't find you. So I checked outside and you were with that preppy kid from the city. You left with him.
That was Kip Sudbury, Leland said. Kip Sudbury.
The name rang a bell, one more recent than that night 30 years ago. Was he a Wall Street guy? A hedge fund guy?
He was involved in that bond scandal back in...
Oh, right, Frey said.
He took me to 21 Federal to meet his friends, and the next day we went sailing on his father's yacht.
Well, I sat in the back of Mal's blazer and drank by myself until the bar closed, Frey said. Memory was a slippery thing. Frey couldn't remember what he'd been served for lunch on his plane earlier that day, but he could vividly picture himself in his Nirvana t-shirt, smoldering like a red-hot coal in the back of Mal's car. He remembered being tempted to go with Leland and her New York friends because he'd thought he read some apprehension in her expression. But then Frey realized that what Leland feared was him coming along. She didn't want him to embarrass her and expose her for the regular Baltimore girl she was.
And then, when we got back to the cottage, we realized Coop had left the island, and I snatched a bottle of Jim Beam and headed down the beach.
Leland turned on her side toward him and laid her fingers across his biceps. He inhaled her scent. She had always smelled spicy, like sandalwood and ginger, rather than sweet or floral. That was one of the many things he loved about her.
I stripped down to go for a swim, Frey said. At least, I think that was my intention, because when the paramedics found me, I was buck naked, passed out in the sand.
Leland moved her hand down to Frey's thigh and leaned in so that her chin rested on his shoulder, and her words breathed straight into his ear.
I'm glad nothing happened to you.
I wouldn't say nothing happened. The next morning when I woke up, I realized I had a problem.
Frey often wondered why that had been his aha moment. It wasn't the drunkest he'd ever been. He used to black out all the time at the University of Vermont. And there had been one fateful night during a summer home from college when he bumped into Leland and Mallory at Boeger's downtown. Leland had spent the whole evening talking to Penn Porter, who had been a classmate of Frey's at Calvert Hall, and Frey was jealous. He'd done at least 6 shots of Jägermeister at the bar, and the next thing he knew, he was waking up in Latrobe Park, robbed blind, with bruises all over his body and 2 teeth knocked loose.
I decided I would take a break from drinking.
That was all Frey had intended, a break. He certainly hadn't meant to go the rest of his life without tasting the first sip of an ice-cold beer or the velvety warmth of a good red wine on his tongue. But once the alcohol had cleared from his system, he liked how he felt. Powerful. In control. The control was its own high, and, if you listen to Anna, he was addicted to it.
The break has lasted 30 years.
Leland kissed his cheek. Her hand remained on his thigh, which could only be interpreted one way. Frey felt himself stiffen beneath his jeans. Anna had convinced him he was washed up sexually, but that had been an excuse she invented so she could justify sleeping with Tyler.
I'm sorry for my part in it, Leland whispered.
Frey shook his head.
I blamed you initially because you were the easy target. My first love, the one I couldn't get out of my system.
When I landed here this afternoon, I was thinking about our first date in the hot tub.
Frey was so hard, he had to adjust himself subtly. The last thing he wanted was for Leland to move her hand.
You'd probably be uncomfortable to know how many times I've played back that scene in my head when I'm alone.
Frey, seriously?
Leland Gladstone, the feminist, might have been offended to know that she was the subject of his sexual fantasies, but Leland Gladstone, the woman lying next to him, sounded flattered.
It was a horny teenager's wet dream, Frey said. Coming back out to the hot tub to find you topless?
Leland propped herself on her elbow and gazed down at him. He could see that she was older. There were lines at her eyes and around her mouth, but she was still the same smart, sassy, complicated person he fell in love with another lifetime ago. Frey's upbringing, seen through the lens of 2023, might be described as compromised, meager, possibly even traumatic. His mother, Sloane, was wild and rebellious. She got pregnant with Frey when she was 21 and couldn't identify the father. There had simply been too many men, many of them sailors in port in Baltimore for a few days before shipping out. Frey's grandparents, Walt and Ida, took on the job of raising Frey. They were kind, but their household was abstemious. Walt and Ida didn't drink, didn't smoke, didn't swear. They didn't allow Frey to eat potato chips or Cap'n Crunch, or drink Coke or chew bubblegum. His bedtime was 9 o'clock sharp. He had never once been allowed to stay up to watch Taxi, Barney Miller, or Magnum P.I. If Ida could hear his music playing through his bedroom door, it was too loud. Sloane would live with them periodically when she was between boyfriends and had nowhere else to go, and she acted more like an older sister than a mom. It was Sloane who had offered Frey his first cigarette at 14, his first drink at 15, his first toke of marijuana at 16. She did these things only when Walt and Ida were away or out of the house. "Your grandparents," Sloane would say. She always referred to Walt and Ida as "your grandparents," as though they were of no relation to her. "Think I'm a bad influence on you." She was, of course. His own mother was a bad influence. In the face of that, Leland's love had been a life raft. As soon as Frey and Leland started dating, Frey stopped spending so much time at the Blessing House. Senior and Kitty had always been welcoming and inclusive, though Frey suspected they pitied him. He'd once overheard Kitty referred to Sloane as a perennial party girl, a term he knew was unflattering, but also not the worst thing she could have said. Frey found he felt more comfortable across the street with the Gladstones. Steve Gladstone took Frey under his wing, often taking Frey along on errands to the hardware or auto parts store, saying he was grateful to have another man around. Steve and Jerry came to every single one of Frey's lacrosse games junior and senior year, cheering for him as loudly as real parents might have. When Frey left for college in Burlington, he and Leland broke up for the first time. She was still only a junior in high school, and they both agreed the mature decision was to split up and see what happened. What happened was that they spent a small fortune on long-distance calls, and there were plenty of conversations that ended with one or the other of them slamming down the phone. But every time Frey returned to Baltimore, his first stop would be the Gladstones, even before his own house. Frazier Dooley had loved Leland Gladstone. She was a key part of his personal history. Last night on the beach, there had been nothing to stop them from making out on the blanket like the crazy kids they once were, before standing up and going back inside to lock themselves in Mallory's bedroom. Frey's phone rings again when he's underneath the covers, gently nibbling on Leland's hip bone, a sex move he feels he invented because Leland says,
"God, nobody has done that to me in decades. Please don't stop."
He hears the vibrating of his phone on the nightstand, and when Leland says,
"Who's dead to me?"
Frey tells her to ignore it. After making love, they decide to go out for breakfast. Leland scurries into the bathroom to freshen up, and Frey checks his phone. Anna didn't leave a message. It's 9:30 in the morning on Nantucket, 6:30 in Seattle. He clicks on her texts, in case there's an emergency with Cassie, their 10-year-old daughter.
You're unbelievable. Talk about a hypocrite. Check page 6.
What? Frey thinks. Leland comes out of the bathroom. She's glowing, as luminous as he's ever seen her.
Everything okay?
Yeah, Frey says. He plucks his underwear from the floor.
Let's not bother showering, Leland says, tousling his hair. We're just going to swim when we get back anyway, and I'm starving.
Me too, Frey says. I just need to stop and get a copy of the New York Post on our way.
Leland laughs. I thought I was the only person I knew who read the Post, she says. Fifi used to give me so much jazz about it.
Everyone reads the Post, Frey says, but only the brave admit it.
Coop is passed out on the sofa, and Jake is nowhere to be found. So Frey jots a note saying he and Leland are taking the Jeep to breakfast. He drives to the big Mid-Island grocery store and leaves Leland in the car as he runs in to get the newspaper. Page 6? Is he on page 6?
Talk about a hypocrite.
What does that mean?
Leland had asked about Anna the night before, but Frey dodged the question. His divorce was the last thing he wanted to talk about. He imagined that getting divorced as a regular person, an accountant in Cheyenne or a florist in Shreveport, would be painful and difficult enough, but as a very wealthy, semi-famous person, it was a whole other circle of hell. Frey and Anna's story, although not unique, was a source of endless tabloid fascination. Anna had cheated on Frey with Tyler Toledo, the manager of her former band, Drank. They had been spotted out to dinner at Lausanne by one of Frey's vice presidents while Frey was down in South America on business and while Cassie was home with a sitter. When Frey asked Anna about it, she broke down in tears and said that yes, she and Tyler had been seeing each other for 9 months and it was all Frey's fault because he had robbed Anna of any identity except for that of Fraser Dooley's wife and Cassie Dooley's mother. She used to be interesting, she said. She used to be cool. Now, she was just another Botoxed Seattle socialite with a private Pilates instructor and a 12,000-square-foot glass house on Puget Sound. Frey had asked Anna if she was in love with Tyler, and Anna had said she was, though it was clear from both her facial expression and her tone that she was lying. She didn't love Tyler Toledo. Sleeping with him was an act of rebellion, a cry for attention. Frey did a little investigative work and found out that Tyler's best days had been when he was managing Drank. Since then, he had couch-surfed his way around Queen Anne and Capitol Hill. He'd even been homeless for a while. Certainly, reuniting with Anna, Drank's former bassist, had been a huge boost to him, especially since she was married to the 8th richest man in Seattle. Frey thought maybe he could pay Tyler off to make him go away, but when this was intimated, Tyler doubled down and leaked the scandal of his affair with Anna to Google News, and in a nanosecond, it was everywhere. It was news of the scandal rather than the scandal itself that led to the divorce. Frey could have forgiven the infidelity. What he could not forgive was Anna on TMZ both disparaging him and shamelessly promoting old songs by Drank. It worked. Their song, Back It Up, had a surge on iTunes. The tabloids gobbled up the seedy aspects of the story, which was bad for everyone involved, but especially for Cassie. 10 was such a tricky age. Cassie was old enough to understand what was going on, but not old enough to understand why. And Anna had broken every single rule in the evolved parenting handbook.
She thought nothing of bad-mouthing Frey in front of Cassie any chance she could get. Frey agreed to a $280 million settlement only because he wanted the whole thing to be over. He grabs the last copy of the Post at the Stop and Shop and somehow resists looking at the paper in line. When he gets back to the car, Leland has the radio cranked to the rock station, playing the top 500 songs of all time, and she's singing along to Heaven by Bryan Adams.
You're all that I want. You're all that I need.
She turns down the music and grins at him.
This song has always reminded me of the Calvert Hall Junior Prom. Remember my lavender dress?
Frey shakes his head, but he can't stop his smile.
I need coffee, he says.
Fraser Dooley loves nothing more than a good breakfast place, and as soon as he sees Island Kitchen, he knows he's found one. It's mid-island, right across the street from the Stop and Shop, as it turns out, so it doesn't have a water view, but the place is loaded with character. The post and beam construction is charming. There are lush pink impatiens in the window boxes. It feels rustic and homey, like the island's kitchen. Frey and Leland are seated at a two-top inside where Frey immediately detects the scent of Frayed Edge Classic Black. This comes as no surprise because it was his New England sales manager who gave him the name of this place. A server with a dark ponytail and freckles, her name tag says Sarah, comes over holding the signature Frayed Edge silver pot and says, "Coffee?"
"Please," Frey says, nudging the chunky ceramic mug forward.
"I'll have tea," Leland says. "Herbal, if you have it."
"Right away," Sarah says.
She pours Frey's coffee and, despite the steam, Frey can't get it to his mouth fast enough. He looks at Leland.
"You're on a date with me, and you're ordering tea?
Herbal tea?"
Leland laughs.
"I did it just for that reaction."
"Excuse me," Frey calls out. "My beautiful friend here will have coffee as well. This is Frayed Edge, right?"
"That's all we serve," Sarah says.
She takes a second look at Frey, and he watches recognition cross her face.
"Oh my God, you're..."
Leland hoots.
"Do you get recognized everywhere you go?"
Sarah pours Leland's coffee and lowers her voice.
"Someone called us yesterday to say you might be coming in. They wanted to make sure we had the signature pots and all the signage."
"It looks great," Frey says.
Sarah turns her attention to Leland.
"Oh," she says, "you're the woman from the New York Post."
"I don't work at the Post," Leland says. "I'm Leland Gladstone of Leland's Letter."
Frey gets a sinking feeling. The Post is folded in half on the bench next to him.
"We'll be ready to order in just a minute," he says.
Frey finishes his first cup of coffee and decides to distract Leland with another topic they've been avoiding: their parents. 25 years earlier, Steve Gladstone and Frey's mother, Sloane, had an affair. Steve ended up leaving Jerry Gladstone and marrying Sloane. Frey speaks to his mother sporadically, but he hasn't seen her and Steve in a few years. He gathers that Leland keeps contact to a minimum as well. She aligned herself staunchly with Jerry. He reaches for Leland's hand.
"How funny would it be if we called Steve and Sloane on the way home and told them we're back together?"
"I'm trying to forget the unfortunate fact that we're actually step-siblings," Leland says.
At that instant, Leland's phone pings and she checks the text.
"It's my mother. She... I kid you not, just look at this. She says, 'Are you with Fraser Dooley?'"
Leland holds up the screen of her phone.
"Tell me that's not spooky."
Sarah shows up with the silver pot and refills both their cups. Frey is starting to sweat.
"We're ready to order," he says. "I'll have the panko eggs Benedict."
"And I'll have the bananas Foster French toast,"
Leland says. Sarah leaves, and Frey feels his phone buzz again. Dead to me. He declines the call and sighs.